description they can think of. And I'm not going to better describe that. We, as all Palestinians, as all, you know, people who are seeing it, you know, see a genocide unfold with, you know, with our own eyes, on camera, on Instagram, on social media, whilst our political class are 100% backing it, we've completely been lost for words. There's nothing that can describe it better than
what kind of action will you take? Because we're in an election year, not just here in the UK, but in the States and more than 50 other countries. When you see this dithering on the part of the political class here, as you put it, be it the Conservatives or Labour, someone as young as you and the likes of you out there, how will you get back at these people in power who can stop a genocide but won't or haven't so far?
Well, very simply, I would refuse to vote for any of these supposed representative parties. You know, many people make the comment that if I was to not vote for Keir Starmer or Labour, that would make a conservative leadership more likely. The very simple fact is that if we're going to profess to be in a democracy, then I have every right to have a party that represents me. If we are in a professed democracy, why am I being forced in practically to vote for people who we all know don't represent me and have no intention of representing me and the vast majority of the British public, which, as I'm sure you understand, 67%, I believe.
66%.
Support an immediate ceasefire. And yet, like you were saying, there's a complete, you know, undemocratic and extremist attitude towards this that has justified, as we speak, the genocide of my people. And I'm not going to, you know, vote or put my support behind anyone that hasn't done everything in their power possible to stop that.
And the rise in the number of independent candidates and minor parties is probably going to put an end to that political duopoly in Westminster.
Well, I hope so.
That is the hope. Rick, we've passed 150 days, as I mentioned earlier, of this relentless bombardment. What is your assessment of where things stand?
Well, in 1967, the U.S. launched a surprise attack on its Arab neighbors, and in 6 days, they were able to decimate the air forces of those neighbors and win that war. In contrast, we've got 150 days or 5 full months of Israeli slaughter, massacre, and killing, and they are nowhere near achieving their goals. The Palestinian resistance has withstood this onslaught, this slaughter, and I think the Israeli government is desperate because they can see that their goal of winning a quick victory is not being achieved. They can see that the world is increasingly turning against them, even the West, so that the U.S. is, you know, almost alone. They're not entirely alone. Germany and the U.K. and France are still supporting them, but less and less so. So the pressure is building, and Netanyahu is desperate, and in a way, the U.S. is desperate to see this come to an end.
Sure is desperate. There's, of course, divisions inside the Israeli so-called war cabinet. We'll talk about that in a little later in the program. But meantime, the U.S., Qatar, and Egypt have been attempting to hammer out a ceasefire agreement, at least on the look of it, for a number of weeks with seemingly little progress, despite early optimism. Earlier this week, the Egyptian foreign minister, Sameh Shoukry, met his Dutch counterpart for talks where the fate of the negotiations was outlined. Rick, let me come to you for this one as well. The Israelis have not bothered to send any negotiators to these talks going on in Cairo. Does this tell you just how little regard they have for the whole process?
Well, it's an indicator, and it's going to be interesting to see what they report back to the International Court of Justice, because they're coming up on the deadline where they have to report. Meanwhile, their overlords in Washington are in deep trouble, just as in British politics, we're seeing upheavals with George Galloway winning a landslide victory. 7 days ago, we had a Democratic Party primary race in Michigan, which is a very key state in the United States election process. And over 100,000 registered Democrats voted uncommitted. So this is a sign. Ideologically, Biden is a Zionist. He's dependent on Zionist funds, and yet most of the party is not feeling that way, and is increasingly wondering what the heck is going on. So it's the same thing as your guest from Britain was saying, where there's increasingly a contradiction between democracy and what we're seeing in reality.
Do those electoral developments in the States perhaps explain the Biden administration's eagerness to claim victory in some kind of a temporary truce?
I think they would be very happy to have that happen, but it's a bit of a smokescreen because they're talking about, just like you say, a temporary truce, and whereas other people are saying that we need to have a ceasefire that stops it once and for all.
Correct. And Tariq, Egypt, one of the parties to these ongoing negotiations, could they do more? And could the Arab bloc overall do more to bring an end to this?
I think there's a lot they can do to alleviate the suffering that Gazans are going through at the moment. The borders are still not as open as they should be. There's still not enough aid getting through. And I don't want to say that's the fault of Egypt in so much as it's the fault of the Egyptian leadership, which is an important distinction to make. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think we can all agree that Egyptian leadership, just as much of the Arab leadership, is not at all representative of the population and the people in these countries. What we are definitely seeing is a very lackluster response. I think all of us Arab Palestinians are utterly disappointed in what has been, little more than words and messages, and a couple nothing more than sort of virtual signalling, sort of technical achievements of dropping some limited amounts of aid.
Yeah.
When we're talking about the mass starvation of 2 million people right at their border. So of course there's more they can do. So more they could have done over the past, not just since 7th of October, but for the past 50 years or so, that they've sat idly, maybe not completely idly, but for the current regime has sat idly by as they've seen their brothers across the border under siege for decades now. And I can't say I'm surprised, but I'm definitely disappointed.
And yet some of them normalized ties
apartheid
Israel too, didn't they?
Jordan have normalized ties with Israel.
UAE,
and they've used that, of course, as an excuse.
All right. Thank you for that. That is all the time we have. My thanks to our guest, Tariq Uthman, here in the studio with me, and Rick Sterling. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts. Goodbye.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very important question, And that question is particularly significant for young people because, as you know, young people, you know, they like to get together, they like to hang out and spend time with one another, especially outside. They like to go outside with one another, different places, and talk and sit. And so for Muslim youth who are, you know, religious and who want to adhere to the tenets of Islam, sometimes a question arises, and that is it permissible to go to any and every place and hang out there and sit there and patronize there? Or are there some restrictions within Islam concerning this? This is the question, an issue that we want to tackle today. Let's begin with a verse of the Holy Quran. In this verse of the Holy Quran, Allah Ta'ala, He says, "Certainly He has sent down to you in the book that when you hear Allah's signs being disbelieved and derided, do not sit with them until they engage in some other discourse." So here in this verse of the Holy Quran, Allah, he presents us with a very general criterion by means of which we can assess whether it's okay to sit in a certain place and to hang out there and to patronize there or not. And that is that if you are in a certain place where Allah's signs, His ayat, in the words of the Holy Quran, are being ridiculed, are being derided, are being, you know, denied, are being mocked, you know, in such a place it's prohibited to sit there, and rather it's necessary to get up and leave from there. In this connection, we also have many hadiths and traditions. One tradition has been narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam. And now if we pay attention, we can see that, you know, these hadiths, they mention instances for that general rule that the Quran, you know, it presented us with. By way of example, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said the following: "Do not sit at a table on which wine is served, for a man does not know when he is overcome by death." So this is, in fact, one of the cases, one of the instances and cases in places where we're not allowed to sit, and that is to sitting in a table where wine is being served. You know, the rulings of intoxicants, they're very strict within Islam. Not only is it prohibited to consume an intoxicant, personally consume an intoxicant, as you know, it's so prohibited you're not even allowed to sit at a table where such an intoxicant, another person might be consuming it, or even the place where it's just being served. In fact, many mujtahids, many experts in religious jurisprudence, they've even said that drinking a liquid which is permissible to drink, a halal, you know, a liquid like water, drinking it in such a manner that alcoholics drink alcohol, even that is, you know, prohibited. Like clinking a glass with your friend, in emulating an alcoholic person, even that is considered prohibited. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at prohibited places of patronization in the light of the Quran and Hadith. Until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, in the program The Key on RIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. but I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now what we're going to do is to learn a little bit about Quranic taqwa. My resources are limited, my talents are limited, my time is limited. Right now, what's the best focused? How can I help the cause? Given my circumstances and there. So it's the mark of the intelligent. But the Imam, the Prophet, the God also says that this is something that people do not only when financially they're wealthy, not only when things are easy, but also when the person's struggling. I want to give you one example of this. This is from one of our shuhada. His name is Mahdi Bakri. Young man. Even when you see, because he was also a little shorter, so this young man, when you see him, even though he's a commander, you would mistake him for any young man. Looks like in his 30s, okay. They tell a story. Remember, he's the commander of an army. So Mahdi Bakri went to go over and to check a warehouse, to make sure the supplies in the warehouse, he's got to make sure everything's fine. And there's a senior brother over there, a little older brother over there, named Hajj Amrullah. So Hajj Amrullah is over there, and he sees this young man going. So he speaks to Mahdi. He doesn't know who he is. He doesn't know he's the commander of the entire base. He told Mahdi, he said, young man, just standing around over there. Come help like everybody else. You need to get these bags out of here. Come, Bismillah. You got that, young man? So what he doesn't know, one, he's talking to the commander of the entire base. The secondly is that Mahdi's been shot. Mahdi's been shot, so he's shot in his shoulder. So with his shoulder, he can't do anything. But like he's struggling. I mean, he's shot, he went to the doctor, he's back on the base, but wounded. So what happened was Mahdi, without saying anything, he starts helping unload the bags like everybody else. He's doing the work just like everybody else. More than that, he's outworking them. So, not only in times of ease, but also in times of difficulty, outworking them. Hajj Amrullah was so surprised, and he just sees him. Until Dhuhr, Mahdi's over there unloading the trucks just like anybody else. So then Hajj Amrullah was there, and another brother came to give a report now to Hajj Amrullah. When he came to give the report to Hajj Amrullah, he told him, he said that, Hajj Amrullah speaking now, there's this new one hard-working Basiji. I need you to find out who this guy is. He is outgoing everybody. He's working harder than anybody. I want you to talk to his commander, whoever his commander is, and tell him, I want this guy. I want him to be part of working over in this department. So the guy's like, oh, who? So he looks. He sees this guy over in the distance. The guy goes over. He recognizes the commander of the entire army is now this young man. And he's over there working just like anybody else, working harder than everybody else, in difficulty and ease. So as soon as he sees it's the commander, he runs over and he starts helping him. And he turns to the other guy. He's like, do you know who this is? He's like, no. He said, this is the commander of the entire base. The guy's, oh my God, comes over. I'm so sorry. And the guy, Mahdi, just goes over and kisses all of the brothers on their faces. No, I'm just a Basiji just like anybody else. But spending, targeted spending in difficulty and also in ease. The next one is also there. This is again a sign of taqwa. Let's see how much taqwa we have. And of course, it's first for myself. So again, same verse, 3:134. God says this. The people of taqwa are the people who are wal-kadhimin al-ghayz. Those who swallow their anger. swallow their anger. There's a couple of points that we're supposed to remember about this. What's expected from us as a person of taqwa is that I don't make decisions based on anger. Not that I never get angry. There are some verses of the Quran that praise righteous anger. For instance, if we can, this verse is Surah 48 and verse number 29. Because the Quran doesn't contradict itself. Let's just turn for a second. 48:29. وَالَّذِينَ مَعْهُ Those who are with him. أَشِدَّاءُ عَلَى الْكُفَّارِ رُحَمَاءُ بَيْنَهُمْ When it comes to the enemies of Islam, the Yazids of the time, أَشِدَّاءُ عَلَى الْكُفَّارِ There is righteous anger. It isn't the case that the mu'min has no anger, can't turn it on, doesn't have, can't flip this. No, there is anger. The idea is responding out of anger and doing something where I shouldn't be, right? Because I'm so angry and so furious. Next, وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ The person of taqwa is a person who forgives. Am I the kind of person who can forgive? Even the Islamic concept of unilateral forgiveness. So it's not, we're not talking about the enemies of Islam. Family members, people make mistakes, our neighbors, mu'mineen, mu'minat. Can I forgive, and even before people apologize? We're talking about mistakes. People make mistakes. Sometimes you'd be so surprised how people are holding on to things. They're so angry. Whereas the Quran says, وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ Example, we talked about the idea of being Malik Ashtar for the Imam of the time. What was Malik like though, Malik Ashtar? There's a story Shahid Mutahari tells, where Malik Ashtar was walking. The guy doesn't know. The guy in the store who's watching Malik Ashtar doesn't know who Malik Ashtar is. So they're just describing it. Malik Ashtar, tall guy, strong, but battle scarred. Face weather beaten. Battles in those days were with swords, right? Injured. He's even on his face, there were certain marks, scars from some of the battles. And just walking very determinedly, moving in a certain direction. One of the Muslims sees this guy moving in a direction, decides to make fun and let everybody have a good laugh. So he goes and he throws like some garbage on Malik. Malik. And Malik just kept moving. Didn't say anything, just kept moving in the same direction. His friends, one of them came to the guy. They're like, you know who that was? He said, no, I don't know who he is. Nobody. He said, that's the living legend. Malik. The commander of Amirul Mu'mineen. The guy's like, Malik? You mean that? Everybody's terrified about that? He's like, yup. You stepped in it. The guy's like, oh boy. Malik. So the guy starts running now to catch up to Malik. Because he's like, oh, he's the command. Those are the good old days. And he said Malik just kept going. So he's following behind Malik. And he sees that Malik turns suddenly and he goes into masjid. Malik doesn't know he's following him. So he follows. And Malik goes into a masjid and starts making salat. So the guy's waiting. He waits till Malik finishes. Then he walks up to Malik, sits down next to him. He says, you know, assalamu alaikum salam. I'm that guy who, you know, please forgive. I was so ignorant. Apologize. Malik tells him. He said, the reason I can't, because first of all, he explains to him, I'm not going to retaliate. He said, the reason I came to the masjid was I saw what an ignorant act that was. Harming people, no reason, stranger, throwing something. I felt terrible for you. I came to the masjid to ask God to forgive you. Came to pray two rakats and ask Allah to guide and forgive the person. وَالْعَافِينَ عَنِ النَّاسِ The last point that we'll leave for next time, you'll just have to read the verse yourself, is where it explains to us, if you read that last verse, because it's going to end with that, how excellent those workers are. The last verse is this. We're just going to, you'll read it later on your own. The idea that if I have taqwa, it's going to show itself in my reaction time. If I've made a mistake, if a person really has taqwa, all they need is a reminder. If they're still insisting, if they're militant about their mistake, I'm making a mistake, but I'm militant about it, that means the person doesn't have taqwa, but the ayat of the Quran are most beautiful.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Midstream.
On Friday, March 1, Arab aircrafts conducted an airdrop of aid in the northern areas of the Gaza Strip for the first time. However, the hopes of that evening ended with men returning empty-handed. Contrary to the desires of families, yet at least they returned unharmed, unlike the hundreds gunned down by Zionist Israel while trying to get to the aid packages. The first planes appeared in the sky over Jabalia camp in the northern part of the strip and began dropping aid shipments over it. However, the winds did not favor the thousands of displaced people who raised their heads to the sky, anticipating the drop of relief materials among them, but it ended up landing actually on the beach. During the journey from the heart of Jabalia to the northern outskirts to obtain as much aid as possible, tens of thousands of locals marched on foot, covering a distance of over 3 kilometers. When the crowds arrived, the shipments had already been completely emptied, since thousands of residents of that area where the aid fell were waiting for it before it even touched the ground. Those who managed to obtain a bag of flour or a kilogram of dates or a bottle of water reached the outskirts of the camp with their hands and feet bruised from the intense competition and jostling to get even a little to alleviate their hunger and thirst. However, the airdropped food packages did not exceed the payload of half a truck. The information printed on those products indicates that they are sourced from charitable organizations closely associated with the Egyptian army, which raises many questions, on top of which is, why is Egypt airdropping food aid when they can open the borders and let in thousands of trucks per day? Gazans took to social media to vent their frustration at the humiliating manner in which they were treated by the countries that dropped such aid. It is only reasonable for them to be angered by this humiliating act after they lived the horror of the night before, now forever known as the Flower Massacre. The massacre that began on Thursday, February 29, with the journey of hundreds of thousands of men, elderly, women, and young girls who walked towards the Nablus intersection located on Rashid Street, west of Gaza City, where the entrance gate for aid trucks from the south of the strip to the north is located. There, hundreds of thousands of hungry people gathered throughout the night, hoping to get one bag of flour. In the early hours of dawn, as the first aid trucks began to enter, an Israeli tank advanced with them, opening fire with machine guns and shells towards the thousands who crowded around the first truck. At the same time, other armored vehicles advanced, their identity concealed by the intense darkness, and began to run over and crush the crowd of people. In the sky, quadcopter drones flew, releasing heavy gunfire for hours, turning aid into bait to kill even more Palestinians who were not yet killed by genocide or starvation. This is the Middle East Stream, and I'm Marwa Osman. The Zionist enemy continues its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip for the 150th consecutive day. Last week, it carried out the horrific flower massacre on Rashid Street, southwest of Gaza City, targeting isolated civilians awaiting the arrival of aid and flour. The toll rose to more than 360 martyrs and wounded. In conjunction with the enemy's massacres and crimes, it continued to broadcast lies and false claims about what happened. The United States, which with its green light that it gave to the Zionist entity and endless support for the aggression, described the incident as serious and awaited reports on it. To discuss this issue with us from Madrid is Mr. Chema Sanchez, leader of the anti-imperialistas.com group, member of Red Network for the Defense of Humanity, and also self-proclaimed anti-imperialist militant. Thank you very much for being with us, Chema. Now, according to various estimates, there are around a quarter of a million people in the northern part of the Gaza Strip who are moving between destroyed houses and public buildings in an attempt to find something to eat, something to help their families with, some safe shelter that could protect them. Jordan and Egypt, on the other hand, they did some drop for aids, whether food or any medical aid for that matter, via parachutes, which ended up killing more than 360 Palestinian and wounding others by direct Zionist fire, whether for the trucks or for the parachutes that were landing. Was this an attempt to help the Palestinians for real in the northern part of Gaza, or was it a bait to maybe lure in the physically capable men in northern Gaza to simply kill them because these men are capable of protecting their families in the face of Zionist Israel and in the face of any future Zionist reoccupation of the Gaza Strip?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me to this anti-imperialist trench. Certainly any maneuver that even helps or brings closer to the hungry and besieged people will be taken by the Zionists as an opportunity to increase the attacks and their crimes and their genocide of the people, on the people of Gaza. But it is also a formula for laundering, for whitewashing crimes by pretending to be willing to provide aid that had a much simpler and more rational formula, such as passing the aid without restrictions through the land border of Egypt, but without the intervention of the Israeli siege. Therefore, it's obvious that they use it as a bait or as an excuse. It doesn't matter if it's land, it's by land or by sea. They feel unpunished. They feel themselves immune since the international community continues without taking definitive steps in the face of a genocide that is already surpassing the one they used it as a parapet of the Nazis in the Second World War.
Well, Chema, what we saw was definitely something horrific, especially the scenes in the Rashid Street and what followed, because we had more than one flower massacre in the northern part of Gaza because of Zionist Israel and what they say that they are trying to do, when the reality is they are trying to take out as many Palestinians as possible. We see that the danger is now growing, and we see that danger growing while we are approaching the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. And Ramadan is not only known for its sanctity as a month where Muslims fast and do prayers to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but usually in Palestine in specific, the intensity of the struggle of the Palestinian people escalates during the month of Palestine. Not only in Gaza, we have seen over the years in the West Bank, in Al-Quds, where people try to get to the Al-Aqsa Mosque to pray in Ramadan, but the Zionist entity doesn't allow them. So go figure what would happen this year when the genocide against the people of Gaza is still ongoing. But what really hits me is that despite the despair, the chaos, the pain that is found in Gaza, is that only limited to the holy month of Ramadan? Is despair of the Gaza residents only linked to Ramadan? I mean, if they stop this, if they do a ceasefire in Ramadan, does it mean that it's okay for them to continue after the holy month of Ramadan and keep killing the Palestinians?
Well, I really don't think the Zionists respect any Ramadan or any situation they could approach to a worse conditions for the people of Gaza. The desperation inside obviously grows because even like any seriously injured human being, time always runs against the people, no? And at this moment, the possibilities of this genocide claiming more and more lives grows algorithmically as the days goes by. But also, we should not see the situation separately from the global international situation of total war, because Israel continues to be a tool of the empire, a Zionist base at the crossroads of the terrorists, a crossroads of the territories ideal for controlling Asia, Africa, and Europe. The war is also becoming more pronounced in Europe and now, and we see the obvious intention coming to unleash a war, a clash against the anti-imperialist bloc in Europe as well. For this reason, we must not stop making a permanent analysis of the global situation to situate this situation in the global situation and understand that the war has more fronts, and not only in Palestine, although Palestine is the center of the war now. But for this reason, maybe all the pressure of the people all around the world make an easier situation for Palestine people, for Gaza people. But at the same time, this tool, these Zionists, maybe go crazy and go ahead. And then I'm sorry, but I'm sure the Ramadan will be not a stop for them now. Mm-hmm.
Well, Chema, inside of the Zionist entity, we see that Netanyahu, the prime minister of the Israeli entity, is currently finding himself in such a corner under significant international pressure to stop the genocide against the people of the Gaza Strip, and also with pressure coming from inside the Zionist entity itself. But, I mean, as a Lebanese woman, Chema, we know in Lebanon for sure that nothing really can maintain a ceasefire or a halting or a cessation of violence, acts, aggression from the Zionist entity, except one equation, which is a military deterrence equation against the Zionist entity. Nothing else can work. We have tried this before. So who's to say that the Israeli entity won't just continue to hold the card of starvation against the people of Gaza to ensure that, for example, Hamas doesn't take over again the northern part, at least the northern part of Gaza, in the event of a ceasefire? Who's to say they won't just continue with the killing?
I totally agree with you. Yes, they have no other pressure, really pressure, than the military pressure, the military operations of the resistance. And then at the same time, I think we all are hoping for more people, Arab people and anti-imperialist people summing up to the resistance and making this equation a total loss for the Israel and for Zionists. I think it's important to see that the main character of this equation is not Netanyahu. Netanyahu is no more than the other, no more aggressive than the other of the people in Israel. They are all the same. They are a cancer. They are a disease. They are a curse for all the people in the world. And then they must disappear, totally disappear. And this only has no representative man like Netanyahu. They have a representative entity like the imperialism, like the United States. Israel, Netanyahu are nothing without United States and Europe. And Europe and United States are now really pressure for genocide. For genocide continues in Gaza, and then they are the real guilty of the equation. Israel is just the cancer, the center of the cancer, but they are not the actor, the main actor. And Netanyahu is only what the United States of America wants to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, Chema, thank you for explaining how much of a tool Zionist Israel is in the hands of the imperialist United States of America and Europe for that matter. Chema Sanchez, leader of the anti-imperialistas.com group, member of the Red Network for the Defense for Humanity, and also self-proclaimed anti-imperialist militant. Thank you for being with us. Now, ladies and gents, please stay tuned, because next we are going to talk about Netanyahu's plan for the day after the war on Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Although Zionist Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan for the day after the war is filled with generalities and cannot form the basis of a real plan, maintaining Israeli entity security after the major shock caused by the Al-Aqsa flood has become the primary impetus for Netanyahu to implement his plan. Now, it is for a paramount importance to understand the true motivations behind Netanyahu's presentation of this plan, as this serves as a true gateway to comprehending the actual contents of his plan. More details in the following report.
Israeli entity Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu presented his plan last week before the Zionist War Cabinet for the day after the war in Gaza, based on three time frames. First, the short-term phase, where Netanyahu emphasized the immediate transition to post-war conditions, contingent upon achieving all the war's objectives, which he sees as a prerequisite for entering this phase. Second, medium-term phase, Netanyahu wants the Israeli occupation forces to retrain freedom of military and security action within the Gaza Strip by establishing a security buffer zone along the eastern and northern borders, adjacent to the Gaza Envelope settlements, extending at least 1 kilometer into Gaza's territory. This includes control over the Egyptian-Palestinian borders and the Rafah crossing. Regarding governance and civilian life in Gaza, Netanyahu's plan proposes establishing a civil administration and authority in Gaza under the responsibility of local figures with administrative experience, under Arab or international supervision, not affiliated with the Palestinian resistance factions or the Palestinian Authority. In this phase, the plan includes closing the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, and replacing it with other international relief organizations that Zionist Israel approves of. Additionally, a plan to combat what Netanyahu called Palestinian extremism is proposed in all educational and religious institutions in the Gaza Strip. The reconstruction of Gaza will be conditional upon the disarmament of the Gaza Strip and the commencement of a campaign against extremism according to Israeli entity standards. For Netanyahu's long-term phase, he outlined two fundamental pillars. Firstly, Zionist Israel rejects any dictates from the international community regarding a final solution with the Palestinians, insisting that direct negotiations between the two parties without preconditions are the only way to achieve a final solution. Secondly, Zionist Israel refuses to unilaterally recognize the establishment of a Palestinian state by the international community. Understanding the true motives behind Netanyahu's plan is crucial for grasping its actual content. Netanyahu seems to have written this failure of a plan to appease the Americans, but its content is aimed at not angering Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. Above all this is undoubtedly Netanyahu's personal political interest in avoiding responsibility for the failure of handling the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood operation and continuing in his role as Prime Minister. Therefore, many in Zionist Israel see Netanyahu's plan as nothing new, but rather a compilation of his statements throughout the Gaza war, continuing the right-wing ideological line based on the idea that reaching a final solution to the conflict with the Palestinians is not beneficial for the Israeli occupation. Thus, his plan continues to pursue a strategy of conflict management by creating facts on the ground to prevent access to a long-term conflict resolution, which Netanyahu views as in Zionist Israel's supreme interest.
Now to discuss this issue with us, Mr. Patrick Henningsen, independent journalist, geopolitical analyst, host of Sunday Wire radio show. And thank you very, very much for your time, Patrick, for being with us. Now, it seems that Netanyahu has in his short, medium and long-term phases looking at reoccupying the Gaza Strip and taking over also the Egyptian-Palestinian borders while installing some sort of a puppet authority similar maybe to the Palestinian authority in the West Bank. That sounds to me like launching a new war all over again in Gaza. What is your take on that?
Well, it's pretty clear, Marwa. This has the full backing of the United States of America. This has been in the works, carefully planned behind the scenes, away from public view. So you have the situation where you have this rhetoric in the public domain from Tony Blinken, from the U.S. State Department, from the President of the United States himself, plus the United Kingdom, the European Union, all talking about some kind of a peaceful solution, some sort of sustainable ceasefire. All the while, they all know very well, full well, of what's going to come. And what's going to come is a plan to is basically establish, as you said, some sort of security zone. We know Israel likes its buffer zones. Of course, the people in Lebanon know this all too well, and tragically, too. So what we're also seeing here is the fast-tracking of settlements, of putting new people on the ground there to change facts on the ground. This process will also begin. But best laid plans of mice and men, Marwa, unfortunately, it may not work to plan. The situation is very different now than it has been in the past, and they're going to come up against heavy resistance, heavy friction. And this is the thing that they fail to calculate time and time again, especially the Israelis' backers in Washington just completely underestimate the axis of resistance, and they've been doing it consistently, and the results are you have a quagmire here that Israel will probably not be able to manage, nor will the United States, who is backing it.
Well, Patrick, during the stage, especially the medium-term stage, Netanyahu's strategy entails shutting down the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as the UNRWA, and substituting it with what he said are alternative international relief organizations, obviously endorsed by Zionist Israel. Now, is that a decision even within the jurisdiction of the Zionist entity to implement? I mean, the UNRWA is, at the end of the day, a UN body. Who's to say that Netanyahu wants simply incarcerate or even kill the UNRWA employees to scare off any form of working with them or dealing with them on the ground in Gaza?
This is the same sort of problem. You have the Israelis working in a sort of area of fantasy land, of non-reality. The UN Relief and Works Agency scandal that Israel accused it of being, you know, infiltrated by Hamas has been completely debunked many times over, and for weeks now, for over a month now. So there's no basis to those accusations to begin with, but you can see the agenda, and I think you see it all too well, that the United States, Israel, they would like to replace the people in key positions. They want to get their own sort of operatives into place on the ground in Gaza. They want to get U.S. agents into place, Western agents into place, people who are allied with the Zionist entity, as it were, into position there. Because, as you can see from South Africa's ICJ genocide case, UNRWA was very instrumental in providing the actual data, the actual evidence which implicated Israel in genocide. So they're very upset about this. And of course, from that point on, they basically were on a tirade to try to destroy this UNHC. So it is out of their jurisdiction completely, but they're going to press really hard on this because this is about being able to change facts on the ground, to change the narrative on the ground. You do so by replacing the agencies that used to be responsible for providing aid and relief, and then changing all of the staff, changing all of the people in key positions. And basically, by doing that, they can totally transform the story in the eyes of the international community and the UN.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know how much they can actually implement such a thing inside of Gaza when the entire population of Gaza is well aware of any foreign agents that could very much try to probably lurk themselves into the societies and the communities of the people of Gaza, especially after the genocide, Patrick. But Netanyahu, in that plan as well, which is basically just audacious of him to put it pen to paper, but he also blatantly proposed a plan to combat what he referred to as Palestinian extremism, wow, in all educational and religious institutions in the Gaza Strip, putting this step as a precondition for the reconstruction of Gaza. Look at that evil mind there. But don't worry about that. What does he suggest here Zionists do about this? I mean, do they want to install imams in the mosques? Do they want to rewrite history just as they did in the West, for example, especially the Palestinian history, change the academic curriculum for the Palestinians? How is that not an extension of the human genocide? This is a cultural genocide.
So this is just, again, more of the same, changing reality, transforming the narrative. They want to de-radicalize, essentially what they're proposing, to de-radicalize an anti-apartheid armed liberation struggle. We've had those throughout history in many different countries, in many different situations, and you cannot erase them, unfortunately, for the occupiers, unfortunately for colonial oppressors in history. You cannot erase these things. They will persist. So long as the oppression persists, so will the resistance. And we will remind people that the United Nations and international law recognizes the right to an armed resistance for liberation. They have in South Africa, where these people were demonized for decades for resisting apartheid. And now, look, Nelson Mandela is regarded as a hero, winning the Nobel Peace Prize, and the ANC is in power in South Africa right now. You could very well see the same thing in this situation in the future. So again, they're just tinkering with reality. And it was really doomed to fail because it ignores the real fundamental problems that gave us this crisis to begin with.
Mm-hmm. We just have one more minute, Patrick, before we end off this segment. And I want to ask you about the real deal with the upcoming proposed ceasefire. Do you think that the Zionist entity will actually approve of any of the points put forth by the resistance? Because Hamas has been very adamant on taking what it should to prevent any further calamity for the Palestinians. Do you think that the Zionist entity will go ahead and begin a ceasefire?
This is classic Israeli negotiation tactics, which everybody knows all too well, is to create an impossible situation where the other side, in this case Hamas, could never agree to terms, and just to carry on trying to implement and execute their agenda. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to stop doing that. And so the ceasefire will become theater to buy time for Israel to change facts on the ground in their favor. Unfortunately, that's what it looks like to us.
Well, Patrick Henningsen, independent journalist, geopolitical analyst, thanks a million for joining us to discuss this pressing issue, especially in the genocided and killed, maimed, betrayed Gaza Strip. As we speak, ladies and gents, thank you very much for joining us right here on the Mideast Stream. Please keep in mind that we will always remain the voice of the voiceless. We'll see you again next week on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Seven, very much pressure.
We come to you, and oh God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. Over the last few episodes, we discussed certain philosophical books. There is, however, another discipline within the Islamic tradition, which is the discipline of Irfan, or what is known as Islamic mysticism, or Islamic gnosis, and so on and so forth. Islamic spirituality, many, many different names have been given to it. What this kind of means is that there is a discipline that is higher than philosophy, again, generally speaking, and it is a amalgamation, if you like to say, of both the practical and the theoretical, and so on and so forth. Let's put it this way. Irfan, or Islamic spirituality, is broken down into two segments, or two categories. One category is known as Irfan-e-Nazari, or theoretical Irfan. The other part is known as Irfan-e-Amali, which is the practical section of Irfan, which actually a person goes and you know, does the spiritual wayfaring, and so on and so forth. The section that deals with the theoretical side of it is more philosophic, more, you know, demonstration-based, more evidence-based, and so on and so forth. So the book that we would like to introduce today is meant to be a textbook on the theoretical side of Islamic mysticism for a person who's wishing to, you know, a beginner to know about Islamic mysticism. However, it must be understood that Islamic mysticism is better studied after a person has at least a good understanding of Islamic philosophy, because the terms that are used are very philosophical terms and are used itself within the Islamic philosophical tradition. So, inshallah, we hope that you stay tuned to our next segment where we will be introducing this book to our dear listeners.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. So the book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners is titled Mystical Instructions, An Introduction to Islamic Gnosis, Irfan. This book was written by Dr. Muhammad Fanai Ishkavari and was translated from the Persian by Dr. Muhammad Riza Fakhr Rouhani. It was published in Qom by the Urwat al-Wuthqa Institute in the year 2023. So this book is a compilation of 30 lectures of Dr. Ishkavari on Islamic mysticism, but especially on the theoretical side of it. But again, the book contains both, some practical, some historical, some theoretical, because it is a book meant as a textbook. I'm assuming, I have not asked, but I am assuming that the title, Mystical Instructions, follows on from the two other textbooks that were written in this regard on other sciences. For example, we have a book that is known as Theological Instructions, which is a translation of the late marhum Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi's book, Amuz al-Aqaid, which is a textbook on theology. We have another book known as Philosophical Instructions, which is a textbook on Islamic philosophy, again by the late marhum Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, rahmatullah alayh. This one, therefore, is called Mystical Instructions. So I'm assuming it is based on that specific and on that same kind of formula. Again, I do not know. It is an assumption. It is good for us to actually ask the publisher if this is the case. Anyway, this book is based on 30 lectures given by Dr. Ishkavari on Islamic mysticism. For example, by then in this book they call it Gnosis, which doesn't make any difference. Same word with the same meaning, different words with the same meaning, rather. So the first lecture, for example, deals with terminology and preliminary explanations. Lecture 3 deals with the sources of Irfan, for example. Again, we're just going randomly. Lecture 15 deals with God's attributes. And this is where, for example, the theoretical side of Irfan comes through. Wilaya and Imama. And then lecture 21 deals with practical mysticism. Lecture 22, Essential Elements of Practical Mysticism, and so on and so forth. So we can see that this book contains both the theoretical side of Irfan and the practical side of Irfan. Again, as it's meant to be a textbook for a person who is just beginning to study Irfan or Islamic mysticism. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion of this book for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Among the sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past. But where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves?